you need to approve the merchandise quality in order to preserve your mark's legal status. In this case, you should also make sure the merchandiser puts your TM symbol on the goods. Even if you haven't registered your mark, however, you should still insist on approving quality to make sure your image is intact onto a piece of mild cheddar. Your merchandiser will pay the cost of creating artwork for your merch, called origination costs. But this cost is treated as an advance, and therefore comes out of your share of net profits, or out of your royalty. If you have some clout, you may be able to treat origination costs as an expense that's deducted in computing net profits, meaning you only pay a portion of it. But there's usually a cap on what they'll pay on this basis, and anything over the cap comes 100% out of your money. For this reason, you should have approval over what they spend, at least for amounts that go over the cap. If they agree to deduct origination costs off the top, it will be for tour merch only. They'll charge the entire cost against your royalties for D2C and retail. Especially if all the origination costs are charged to you, you should own all the artwork and be able to use it after the term of your merch deal. And even if it's off the top, you should try to get these rights. If you have some clout, you can pull it off. Sell-off rights. At the end of the term, the merchandiser wants the right to sell off any remaining merchandise, usually for a period of 6 months. They should have no right to manufacture after the term, only to sell whatever is on hand. The merchandiser will ask for the right to sell it through wholesale, meaning retail outlets, and D2C, which is reasonable since there won't be any more concerts. You get a royalty for these sales, which is the same as if they were sold under a retail or D2C deal. We'll talk about those in the next chapter. The sell-off period should be non-exclusive, because your new merchandiser will be getting into the market at the same time. You can add a provision that gives you the right to buy the inventory at cost plus 10% to 15% at the end of the term, in which case there would be no sell-off rights. You would then give the goods to your new merchandiser, and in fact, you'll get your new merchandiser to put up the money to buy it. Of course, you'll only do this if you're confident you can sell the stuff. Assuming you're not going to buy the goods, and the merchandiser has a sell-off period, here are some other things to ask for, which are very similar to the sell-off rights under print music deals in the printed music section of Chapter 17. 1. Your contract should say the merchandiser can't stockpile goods. This means it can't manufacture a ton of goods right before the end so that it has a lot of leftovers to sell. Specifically, get language that restricts their manufacturing to only such quantity of goods as is necessary to meet reasonably anticipated sales requirements. 2. Your merchandiser can't do distress sales, meaning they can't sell your goods at super low prices just to get rid of them. This practice is also called dumping. Otherwise, you'll be adorning a lot of 99-cent store shoppers and swap meet fans. It also perturbs your new merchandiser, who's trying to sell your stuff at full price. However, this has become extremely hard to get over the years, as merchandisers' profits have been squeezed and their tolerance for dining on leftover goods has been stretched to the regurgitation point. 3. At the end of the sell-off period, they should again offer you the remaining merchandise at their cost, plus 5% to 15%. If you decide not to buy it, they should have to destroy it, or else donate it to a charity. Bootleggers. Merchandisers want the right, and you should encourage them, to chase bootleggers. The term bootlegger was coined in the 1890s because people illegally sold booze to Native Americans by smuggling bottles onto the reservations in the legs of their tall boots. During Prohibition, it came to mean anyone who illegally sold booze. The modern-day equivalent of these fine citizens are people who, without any authority, manufacture merchandise with your name and or likeness on it, and sell it outside the venues. Legitimate merchandisers are always inside the facility. Bootleggers are the guys who hit you on the street or in the parking lot. One of their tricks is to hire college students for $100 or so per night, so the vendors look wholesome, clean-cut, and somewhat innocent, while the manufacturers stay out of sight. Not only are these people costing you money because you don't get paid for the merchandise, but their goods are usually of inferior quality. And guess who gets the complaint letters when some Tuscaloosa fan's t-shirt shrinks to fit her Barbie doll? The legitimate merchandisers have been relatively successful in dealing with these pieces of slime and have found that in some cases they are large, sophisticated operations. One even owned its own t-shirt factory. Through means I'm not free to tell you, the merchandisers have been able to track the bootleggers down and get the courts to stop them. The laws abroad aren't always so hospitable, by the way. The merchandisers will ask you to pay part of the money to chase the pirates, but if you have some clout, they'll front it and charge it back to you, either out of any money recovered from the bootlegger and/or from your other royalties. You can also do your part in this game of hide-and-seek. Use your social media to post pictures of official merchandise and let your fans know that the pirated stuff is really shoddy. Also, educate them that they shouldn't buy anything outside the venue. Chapter 25. Retail, direct-to-consumer, D2C merchandising, and fan clubs. Retail merchandising. Retail merchandising means, as the name implies, selling merchandise through retail stores, Hot Topic, Zumiez, Urban Outfitters, Walmart, H&M, Zara, Gucci, etc., and their websites. It can be a significant way for an artist to make money. Don't take it personally, but not all artists have retail sales appeal. You have to be pretty high profile before stores will give your merch any of their floor space, because if a pair of yoga pants will sell better than you, you're out. But when you get big enough to be loved by the mall stores and mass market stores, Walmart, Target, Gap, Taco Bell, maybe not the last one, you can get into 6- or 7-figure retail merch money. So how do you get your goods from the oven to a retail rack? You make a deal with a retail merchandise company who creates the products and sells them to the retail stores. Unlike tour deals, you don't get a share of profits in these deals, but rather you get a royalty percentage of the wholesale sales price, the same way record royalties are computed. So for example, if you have a 20% royalty and there's a $10 wholesale price, you get $2 per unit, regardless of the cost of the goods, shipping, and all the other costs. The merch company's job is to get your stuff into as many stores as possible. Sometimes that means selling directly to the stores, and sometimes they sell via sales reps, people who don't work for the company but make a business out of representing companies and going to the stores and saying, "You gotta have this t-shirt." For certain types of goods, the merchandiser licenses your merch rights to other companies who specialize in a particular niche. In other words, they A. give another company the right to make a product with your approved photo, imagery, likeness, or logo, B. get paid by that company for the merch they sell, and C. split the money with you. This is called a sub-license, because the merch company licenses the rights from you, then under that license, sub that license, meaning under it, like a submarine, re-licenses those rights to someone else. Many of these deals are in small areas, such as stickers, belt buckles, patches, trading cards, condoms, etc. But some can be really big, such as liquor or slot machines. The merchandisers keep a percentage of the sub-licensing income, ranging generally from 15% to 25%. In other words, they make a deal with a company to manufacture and sell bumper stickers with your name, then pay you 75% to 85% of the royalties and advances they get from the sticker company. In exchange for their percentage, they negotiate and sign the license agreement, then police it, meaning they make sure the merch quality is there, that the sublicensee does their job, and that you and your merchandiser get paid. As you move further into the superstar realm, you may want to make some of these deals directly. However, entering into a lot of small licensing agreements is best described as a pain in the butt for little money. So paying this percentage is usually worth it. It's more worthwhile to do it yourself for the really big deals, like liquor or slot machines. But if the merchandiser delivers you a major opportunity and uses their expertise to maximize it, they bring value to the table. By the way, a lot of these deals can be on the tacky side, and since they don't generate much money, a lot of artists don't do them at all. No reason to risk damaging your cachet for peanuts. So make sure you have approval of all sub-licenses. Now, I got this snow globe opportunity for you that's gonna be huge. Picture a little statue of yourself inside this glass ball with gold glitter. Royalties. The royalties for retail merch that's sold by your merchandiser, things like t-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, posters, buttons, cards, belt buckles, etc., are generally in the following range. When your merchandiser sublicenses, it will get a royalty from the licensee in this range, and you'll get your percentage of that, as we just discussed. 1. United States retail sales. 20% to 30% of the wholesale price for top-line/specialty retailers, depending on bargaining power. For the mid-level stores, JCPenney, etc., you'll get 75% of these rates, 15% to 22.5%. And for mass marketers, Kmart, Walmart, Target, you'll get 50%, 10% to 15%. The reason for lower royalties is simple. Stores that push out tons of merchandise have a lot of clout, and they beat up the merchandise distributor to give them lower prices, which means there's less profit for the merchandiser, so they can't afford to pay a full royalty. It's just like that great schoolyard tradition. He who gets beaten up by the bully turns around and beats up the next smaller person. 2. Foreign sales, roughly 80% of the U.S. rates. Other deal points. Other than the royalty calculations, when you make a retail merchandise deal, most of the considerations are actually the same as tour merchandising deals, such as 1. Approval of the merchandise items. 2. Approval of your likeness. 3. Approval of the designs and layout. 4. Restrictions on sell-off rights. 5. Right to purchase merchandise at the end. In addition, there are a couple of points peculiar to retail. Approval of sublicenses. As we discussed, you want the right to approve all agreements that your merchandiser makes with sublicensees, as we just discussed earlier in this chapter. Cross-collateralization. If your retail agreement is with the same company that has your tour merchandise, which it almost always is, you have to deal with whether the advance under the tour agreement is cross-collateralized with the retail deal, and vice versa. For a discussion of cross-collateralization, refer back to the end of Chapter 8. Cross-collateralization is never good for you, but it usually means you get a bigger advance because the merchandiser is spreading their risk. So allow cross-collateralizing only if they offer you a humongous amount of money that you can't get any other way. Direct-to-consumer, D2C, e-commerce/internet sales. As we discussed, D2C, also known as e-commerce and internet sales, means selling merch through your official web store, on your website, and via links to your social media. D2C started with wearable goods, t t-shirts, hats, etc., but has grown to include things like concert tickets, VIP experiences, refer back to Chapter 23 for what those are, and fan clubs. If you're big enough, D2C sales can exceed tour or retail earnings, but to make that happen, you need a good merch partner to set up and execute all this. In the beginning, you can do your own D2C by manufacturing your own merchandise, then hiring someone to take the online orders, collect the money, and ship the goods. There are companies who do this for a percentage. As you move up, however, your volume will get too big for this kind of operation, and you'll need a merchandising company to take it over. In part, this is because you need someone to handle the larger volume, but even more importantly, it's to get their expertise in designing and marketing product for D2C. For example, a good merchandiser knows how to analyze fan data to design merchandise that can maximize your sales. When you license your D2C rights to a merchandiser, the U.S. royalty rates are in the range of 25% to 35%. Foreign royalties are about 80% of those. Note this is higher than the 20% to 30% royalty we discussed for retail merchandise in the last section. And even more important, your D2C royalty rate is applied to the retail selling price of the goods, less sales tax, shipping, credit card fees, and the like, as opposed to retail merchandise royalties, which are applied to the wholesale price. Since the retail price is obviously higher than wholesale, you can quickly see that you're getting much more money per unit on D2C than you are on retail, a higher percentage applied against a higher price. Merchandisers can afford to do this because they're the actual retailer who's selling directly to the public, meaning there's no store taking a profit in between the merchandiser and the fan. In fact, in D2C, there's no wholesale price at all, just the price to the consumer. So the merchandiser gets more money, and you get a bigger piece. Another plus for D2C is that when your merch is sold by a retailer or on tour, you have no idea who bought it. With D2C, when a fan buys something on your web store, you know their name, email, and address, meaning you have a way to talk to them in the future, meaning you can keep them engaged with your career by feeding them information, meaning you can pitch them to buy more merchandise, tickets, VIP packages, etc. To your fans, the web store looks like it's run by you because the merchandiser invisibly handles the back end, taking orders, collecting money, shipping, etc. This is very cool, but it also means that it's your image on the front line with your audience. Fans who spend money on your web store are likely your most die-hard fans, and you don't want to upset them if something goes wrong and it's not fixed right away. If someone orders a kiddie t-shirt and gets a bumper sticker that says, "Up yours," it's not the merchandise company's name that'll be in the angry tweets. So it's critical to have a solid company running the machinery behind the curtain. We talked about bootleggers at concerts, and I suspect you won't be shocked to hear they're even more alive and well online. These sleazes sell phony goods on the auction sites, as well as a few places that specialize in knockoff goods. So be sure your D2C merchandiser has the resources to fight these scuzz bags. In addition to these unique D2C issues, all the merchandising points we previously covered, artwork, approvals, sell-off, etc., apply to D2C as well. Fan clubs. Fan clubs are still around, but they're far less meaningful than they were in the past, and they're dwindling. Here's why. The purpose of fan clubs is to develop a community of your most loyal fans so you can talk directly to them. In the dark days before the internet, the only way to communicate with your fans was to go on radio or TV or do interviews in magazines and newspaper. So fan clubs started as a way to create an insider experience for the most loyal fans. These fans sent in their dues by mail, got back a membership card to impress their friends, and also got exclusive content during the year, a newsletter, photos, information about the artist that wasn't yet public, etc. And the artist made money on the fan club because of the membership fees. Today, artists are constantly talking to their fans over social media, and every major event is immediately spread all over the web. So the fan club experience of directly communicating with your peeps is so 1980s. The only stuff a fan club can really offer is things like early access to tickets, or maybe streaming a record ahead of release, or a chance to win an exclusive experience with the artist. And even then, to make a fan club really viable, artists have to commit some serious time to creating exclusive content for the club. Most artists no longer bother to do that, since their fans are already getting real-time communication every time the artist goes to the grocery store. For these reasons, I'm told only about 15% of artists have a fan club these days, and a good number of those are free to join. The reason a lot of artists stopped asking for membership fees is that they decided it's more important to build a database of fans than it is to charge dues. The ones who still require members to pay fees are usually major live performers who incentivize fans to join by giving them early access to tickets. Even if fan club membership is free, you can still make money through the club by selling tickets or merchandise, especially if it's stuff you can only get if you're a member. If you're selling merchandise, your share is the D2C royalty we just discussed. For tickets, as we discussed in Chapter 23, artists can get the right to sell a certain number of tickets through their fan club, and most merchandisers are set up to handle the ticket sales for you. Just like D2C merch, it looks like the fan club is selling the tickets, but it's really the merchandiser in the back room doing the heavy lifting. Their deal is to add a fee per ticket, usually a few bucks, on top of the face value, which compensates them for handling the sales. Caution. Before you tackle the rest of the book, be sure you have a pretty good understanding of record and publishing basics in chapters 7, 8, 15, 16, and 18. If you skipped ahead and don't already know this stuff, I suggest you go back. Even if you're listening straight through, you might want to review those chapters quickly. The areas we're about to discuss are a bit complex, and you need a solid grasp of the basics before attempting them. Keep your arms and legs inside the car at all times. If you're on the fast track or advanced overview and you're interested in classical music, go to chapter 26. If classical music puts you to sleep, saunter on over to motion picture music in chapter 27. If you answered none of the above, fast track to the conclusion. Part 7. Classical Music. Chapter 26. Classical Music. I shall now tap my baton on the music stand to politely engage your attention as we move into the world of classical music. Please do not applaud between movements and speak only in quiet, mellifluous tones for the duration of this chapter. The major labels and a few larger independent classical labels still do deals on the same basis as all other kinds of music, meaning the structure of a royalty, advance, etc., that we've already discussed. In particular, crossover artists like Andrea Bocelli, crossover meaning their appeal extends beyond the classical market to other genres, have deals that are virtually identical to the contracts we've discussed for pop artists. But these deals are the exception. And why, you ask? To use a refined term, the economics of classical music suck. For example, the cost of recording a full orchestra can run $150,000 to $400,000, and typical album sales, at the time of this writing, CD and download sales are still the mainstay, are in the 5,000 to 15,000 unit range worldwide. Remember, the sales levels in the earlier chapters for pop artists are only for the United States. In fact, a big seller classical album is 50,000 worldwide. Meanwhile, CDs and downloads are both declining rapidly, while streaming is just starting to kick in. By the way, the recording costs I just gave you are typical for studio albums in the United States, where it's particularly expensive to record classical. That's because the AFM sets minimums for recording the musicians that make it far more expensive to record here than in Europe, at least other than the United Kingdom, where the unions aren't as involved in recording. However, live albums have recently gotten much cheaper in the United States due to a new AFM union agreement that swapped a lower upfront fee, about 20% of the union fees for a studio album, for a big piece of the income. Specifically, if the orchestra owns the recording and enters into a distribution deal, the union gets 55% of the recording's gross receipts. But even with the union's concession, if you do the math and throw in some marketing dollars, a traditional classical music recording can't make any money. Moreover, as CDs and downloads disappear, and the traditional classical music consumers go further into their golden years, things are looking even less rosy. And in case that's not bad enough, classical is also disadvantaged in the streaming age. That's because streaming revenue is divided based on the number of plays, and a 20-minute classical piece counts as one play. Perhaps this will change in the future, but as yet, there are no signs of it. If we move to a per-user calculation, refer back to Chapter 12, that would likely make a difference. Also, as we discussed in Chapter 15, publishers get more for streaming long songs, but most classical music is in the public domain, and this formula doesn't apply to masters. So, for the moment, classical is like a neglected cousin. Because of all this, classical record deals have changed to a world where the label is more of a collaborator and distributor than a financier. In other words, the labels pay little or nothing for the albums, but rather just agree to distribute and market them, meaning the artist has to find their own funding, more about that in a minute, deliver a finished album, and then license the rights to the label for distribution, usually for a limited term of 10 years or so. In exchange, the labels often don't even pay royalties. They just give the artist a flat fee of a few thousand dollars, which is less than the recording costs. And if that's not funky enough for you, the labels sometimes make the artist buy a minimum number of units, in the range of 500 to 1,500, to offset their risk. If there is a royalty, it's in the range of 20% to 30%, which sounds high, except that it's computed very differently from the artist royalties for mainstream folks. Instead of the royalty being a percentage of PPD, refer back to the end of Chapter 7 for what that means. It's a percentage of the record company's receipts, meaning what they get from the distributor, in other words, the PPD minus a distribution fee. More and more, this structure is becoming the norm, even in cases where the label pays the recording costs. So if the labels aren't paying recording costs, and the sales can never recoup recording costs, how do classical albums ever get made? The most common answer may surprise you. Rich donors. The major orchestras are all nonprofit organizations who are supported by charitable donations, and they use some of that money to record albums. But why? Who puts money into a deal where they can't ever make it back? Are they idiots? No, they're not stupid. Well, there's this one oboe player. Orchestras know they can't make money from the albums, but they see records as marketing tools that build the orchestra's profile by showcasing them as recording artists. So that's most of the biz these days. Loss leaders. And indeed, because it's only a marketing tool, a number of orchestras, for example, the London Symphony Orchestra, the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, and the Seattle Symphony Orchestra, simply make distribution deals, similar to what we discussed in Chapter 14, with a distribution fee of about 15%. In these cases, They do their own manufacturing, marketing, and promotion, and brand it as their own label. Or sometimes they'll do a hybrid deal, where the orchestra pays the recording costs, but the label pays for physical manufacturing, and shares marketing and promotion, in which case there's a 50-50 profit split. Now let's cleanse our palate with an amuse-bouche, the other terms of a classical record contract. Term and product. Because classical artists don't generally compose the material they record, and because their recordings are in essence live performances, they can make records much faster than pop artists. Also, since the compositions already exist, the recordings can be planned very far in advance, which is not practical in the pop world. So for both of these reasons, classical artists can record several albums per year. Historically, classical deals would commit the company and artist to record 2 or 3 albums per year, and the term of the deal would be for several years, firm. However, as the classical market shriveled and costs continued to rise, multi-album commitments dropped off radically and are rare these days unless you're a very significant artist. Instead, similar to pop deals, the record company commits to one album at a time with options for more. And nowadays, the companies don't even want more than one album per year. They don't think the market can handle more than that without cannibalizing an earlier release. Historically, classical deals had the same exclusivity provisions as pop deals. But as the labels commit to less and less, the artists push back on the exclusivity. Ideally, there's no exclusivity for anything other than audio-only records. But even if the exclusivity is broader, they will, if you ask, carve out broadcasts and simulcasts. Catch-up streaming, meaning a stream of an earlier broadcast, usually on the broadcaster's site, can sometimes get carved out, but often the companies won't do this up front, so the artist and label just work it out on a case-by-case basis. Royalties. If you have a royalty deal, as opposed to the distribution license we already discussed, you won't be surprised to hear that royalties in the classical world are also lower. The good news, however, is that you're paid on every record sold, meaning the company eats all of the recording costs. In other words, the only thing recouped is the advance you put in your pocket. As you've seen, this is a radical difference from the pop world, where the company will recoup anything that crawls. Remember, in this section, we're talking about a traditional classical deal, not crossover artists. Crossover artist deals recoup recording costs just like pop artists. How much lower are classical royalties? A typical deal is in the range of 7.5% to 10%. Refer to the Royalties section of Chapter 9 for the range of pop music royalties. However, classical artists' royalties aren't all in. Refer to the Advances section of Chapter 9, which means you aren't responsible for a producer, and thus you keep all the royalties, though you often have to share them, as I'm about to discuss. Classical albums are frequently an amalgamation of several artists. For example, Yo-Yo Ma plays with the Boston Pops, and Gustavo Dudamel conducts. Since important guest soloists like Yo-Yo get a royalty, and so do major conductors and very successful orchestras, the royalties are spread around. In fact, it's sometimes difficult to tell whose album it is. For the one I just described, is it a Yo-Yo, Boston Pops, or Gustavo album? Just like guest artist recordings on the pop side, refer back to Chapter 12 for what those are, the royalties are allocated among the participants in an agreed proportion. While there's no hard and fast rule, a principal soloist might get 4% to 8%, a conductor 3% to 5%, if there's a conductor royalty. The conductor often gets a flat fee and no royalty. A guest soloist 2% to 3%, if not a flat fee, and a well-known orchestra, 2% to 4%. Advances. As noted above, a typical classical release sells far less units than a typical pop release, or at least far less than what the pop company hopes to sell. So because of this, advances, even for the superstars, are much smaller, typically in the range of $5,000 to $10,000 per album. If an artist has marquee value, meaning that his or her name is recognizable, e.g., Yo-Yo Ma, Plácido Domingo, John Williams, etc., the advance is generally from $15,000 to $50,000. The size of an advance also depends on 1. The extent you participate in the recording. If you're only guesting, for example, your advance will be lower than if you're the principal soloist. 2. The expense of the recording. If you're the principal piano soloist on a recording, for example, you'll get a lower advance for an orchestral recording, which is expensive, than you will for a recording of piano solo works, where they just set up a microphone and drop a few bucks in your brandy snifter. 3. And lastly, your advance depends on that common denominator of all business, clout. Mechanical royalties. Much of classical music is in the public domain, which means there's no mechanical royalties paid for the music. Refer back to Chapter 19 for an explanation of public domain, and Chapter 15 for a discussion of mechanical royalties. However, some of the compositions may be more recent or even contemporary, and the record company has to pay mechanicals to the publishers of these works. Also, as we discussed, arrangements of public domain works are copyrightable if they have enough originality, and these also bear mechanical royalties. When a company has to pay mechanical royalties, there is usually a reduction of your royalty. You're typically charged about half of the burden, although this is negotiable, and it's not always as simple as I've just stated. For example, sometimes the contract just says that your royalty rate goes down a point or two if the company has to pay mechanicals. By an amazing coincidence, this also results in your eating about half of the mechanicals. As we move to a streaming world, where the digital service providers pay the mechanicals rather than the company, you should be sure that your label doesn't reduce you for mechanicals they don't pay. Marketing tie-ins. Because of the limited sales potential of classical recordings, the companies look for alternative ways to market their albums. And marketing is particularly important for big artists who make expensive recordings. The reason isn't just the higher investment. It's because most classical compositions have been recorded many times before by many other artists. So there's a need to convince buyers that this new recording is a must-have. One of the most powerful marketing tools is for you to appear in a public television special or perform a concert tour, open a car dealership, etc. If you have some clout, you can get the label to commit money to these ventures. For example, you might get tour support, which we discussed in Chapter 13, or they might help pay for a PBS special. But while TV shows definitely help sell records, they're very expensive. Public television only pays $50,000 to $100,000 for their programs, and the costs can easily run $500,000 to $700,000 or more. You might get some money back from artsy places like NHK in Japan or Arte in Germany, but not enough to cover the costs of recording the video. So this is only feasible for high-profile orchestras that can self-finance, alone or with the label's help, or individual artists whose labels will pick up the costs to drive visibility and album sales. But as the market shrinks, record company contributions are shriveling with it. If you're on the fast track and you're interested in motion picture music, keep listening. Otherwise, Fast track to the conclusion. Part 8. Motion Picture Music. Chapter 27. Overview of Motion Picture Music. Congratulations, you are now in graduate school. To understand music in films, you need a complete knowledge of the music business, records, copyrights, and publishing, as well as a knowledge of the film business. I couldn't have put this chapter earlier because you wouldn't have been ready for it, but now you are, so let's go. Introduction. I have seen music screw up more motion pictures than bad directors. This is because music is a stepchild in movies. Its budget is small in comparison to the budget of the film, and as you'll see, putting music in films is really complicated. It's normally left until the last minute, at which point there's a massive panic and very little time to get it together. Often this is for a good reason. It may not be possible to record the music until the studio knows exactly what the picture looks like. But many times, it's simply a matter of neglect. As music supervisors became more important in the industry, more about them later, this seems to have changed a little. However, there are always panicked emergencies, no matter what. One song, eight deals. One of the main difficulties is that film people, by and large, don't fully understand music. Not that they should. Their expertise is in making films. And it doesn't help that film music is a twisted tangle of Gordian knots. For example, for every song going into a film, there are always deals to be made with at least three, and often up to eight, different folk. 1. The performer, singer/instrumentalist. 2. The record company to whom the performer is signed. 3. The record producer. 4. The songwriter. 5. The publisher to whom the songwriter is signed. 6. The owner of a master recording that's being licensed into the film or sampled in a song. 7. The publisher who owns a song that's been sampled. 8. The record company putting out the soundtrack album. If you have several songwriters signed to different publishers, several performers signed to different record companies, and a number of samples, you can get up to 15 or 20 deals for just one song. Now, if any of these balls drop while you're juggling, or if any of the rights under one agreement don't match those required by another, the song may have to be trashed. And film producers on a tight delivery schedule with a multi-million dollar film at stake don't like to be told that a song is holding up their picture. Would you? For all these reasons, the music supervisors / business affairs / lawyers / studio executives in charge of film music have extraordinarily difficult jobs. If they deliver the music and pull off a minor miracle by balancing all the competing interests, it was expected, and they're lucky to get a thanks. However, if something goes wrong and the film producer can't use the song, they're the villains. Want to sign up? So, clearing music for films is, as we say in Texas, like being a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. But it's fun and satisfying when it works, and if you're strong of heart, come along and I'll show you this side of the business. The rights involved. Film music rights fall into two categories. Acquisition of rights for the picture. These are deals to put music in the film, meaning deals with 1. Performing artists, 2. Songwriters, composers, publishers, 3. Record producers, 4. Record companies for the right to A. use existing masters or samples, and B. allow one of their exclusive recording artists to create something new for the film. Licenses of rights from the picture company to others. Once the film company acquires the music rights, it makes deals to license that music to other people. Specifically, 1. A deal with a record company to release a soundtrack album. 2. Licensing film clips for music videos. 3. Possibly a publishing administration deal. 4. Possibly a co-promotion deal, something that promotes both the film and a product. Okay, that's a map of the landscape. Let's go visit the hotspots. Chapter 28. Performer Deals. Overview. The deal for an artist to record a song for a film has two distinct parts. One is to use the recording in the picture itself, which is pretty straightforward, and the other is to use the recording on a soundtrack album and/or single, which can be horrendous. Performance in the film. No record rights. The deal for an artist to record a song for a picture is usually a flat fee. No muss, no fuss, no complications. Well, maybe one gigantic complication. Remember, as we discussed at the top of Chapter 13, most record deals say that the record company owns all recordings made during the term, and that language is broad enough to include films. Also, the definition of records in every record deal includes electronic transmissions, understandably, since the world has moved to streaming, which means streaming the film also falls under their exclusivity. So, performing a song in a film requires the record company's consent, and your label becomes a cozy partner in these deals, meaning they'll be wanting a nice chunk of the fee. Often, they'll want all of the fee, particularly if you aren't recouped, but will graciously apply half of that fee against your account. However, this is negotiable, meaning you might get some of the fee paid through to you. Since you can't make this deal without the record company's consent, you have to involve them as soon as a proposal comes up. So before you even start negotiating, you must clear the deal with your record company. In case you didn't hear me, before you start negotiating, you must clear the deal with your record company. And in addition to the record company, if you're writing the song, your publisher will have to license the rights to use it in the film. So you also need them on board at the beginning. Today, the major film companies have been stung enough to make sure the artist's record company and publisher have blessed the deal. But minor and independent film companies may not be so careful, and in the rush of the moment, anyone can slip in a puddle of oops. In addition, there are sometimes missed signals and miscommunications on both sides. For example, a director may have a relationship with an artist, and they get each other all excited and pledge their eternal love without realizing other folks need to come to the party. Or a manager might think he's cleared the rights with the record company, and indeed he has, sort of. For example, he may have discussed it with the company, and the company said it sounds okay. That seems pretty good, but the record company may have only meant their approval was subject to working out a deal to compensate them, while the manager believed he had approval without qualification. So the moral is, have the film company talk directly to the record company. Of course, if your record deal has a built-in exclusion for soundtracks, refer back to Chapter 13, you don't have to worry about this. But most of the time, you don't. And even if you have an exclusion, you may not want to use it for this film. If the record company agrees to a particular soundtrack, you might want to save the exclusion for a time when they don't. Or you may have already used the exclusion. The exclusion may only allow one cut every album cycle or so, and there may be a second film you want to do. Or the film company may require more rights than your exclusion allows. So be sure everyone knows what everyone else is doing. And even if you have that exclusion in your record deal, your publisher will have to be involved if you write the song. Fees. The artist's fee for the film can range anywhere from union scale, refer back to Chapter 8 for what that is, up to $400,000 plus for a major artist. The norm is about $5,000 to $10,000 for a minor artist, escalating to somewhere around $15,000 to $25,000 for a mid-level artist. Superstars tend to be in the $100,000 to $200,000 range, with some occasionally going higher if the film company is hot for them and the star is playing hard to get. Title songs, songs played over the opening or closing credits, pay better than background music. If the artist is also giving the film company soundtrack record rights and songwriting services, big names can get $200,000 to $400,000 plus. Featured instrumentalists, for example, a solo violinist playing over the titles, get fees in the range of $10,000 to $20,000 for lesser knowns, and sometimes as high as $100,000 for big names. Sometimes films use specialty vocalists, the same way that featured instrumentalists are used, sort of like being a vocal instrumental. Usually it's someone well known in their particular genre, like opera, Native American chanting, fraternity songs, etc. These folks usually get a fee of about $10,000 or so per track, though it can go higher if they're well known and their vocal increases awareness of the film. If your fee is at the high end of this range, all or a portion of it will often be treated as an advance against your royalties. We'll discuss soundtrack record royalties in a minute. All-in deals. Some artists prefer to negotiate an all-in fee deal with the film company, which is the same concept as the recording fund we discussed in connection with record deals. For example, for a total of $75,000, they'll record and deliver a completed track. In this case, the artist pays the recording costs out of the $75,000 and keeps the difference as a fee. Unless the fee is extraordinarily high and the artist produces himself or herself, I generally don't like this. Directors are fussy about what goes into their films, and you don't want to be in the position of having to re-record it several times at your expense. Also, if the artist isn't the producer of the recording, you have to pay out a producer's fee, which can be an unknown variable. I much prefer just having the artist show up, sing, and leave. On the other hand, if you're fully self-contained, like an EDM artist who produces yourself and can do the track on your laptop, your costs are minimal and most of the fee goes straight into your pocket. In this case, to the extent you can treat most of the fee as recording costs, your label won't share in that part of it. Shh, don't tell them. Rights granted. If the film company wants to use your song in advertising and marketing the film, the first question, of course, is whether you want this to happen. Your record company will also have an opinion on this, depending on what else they're promoting at the time. For example, if you have a big song out at the same time, they may not want another of your songs in ads for the film. On the other hand, where the film looks to be massive, so that having your song associated with it will help both the song and your career, you'd definitely want them to use your song in advertising and marketing. Always great to have someone spend millions of dollars to pump your music into people's ears. Assuming everyone's cool with it, you don't want to give the film company any more than the right to use your master, A, in the film, B, in the marketing of the film, if that's part of the deal, C, on the soundtrack album, and D, on a single. That means you're excluding things like licenses for commercials, licenses for other films, etc. You and your record company should control these other rights, although they're often restricted, as we'll discuss in a minute. Unless you have very little bargaining power and are up against an obnoxious film company, or unless you're dealing with an animated film where they dig in no matter who you are, none of this should be a serious problem. If you keep all these rights, the usual film studio restriction is that you can't issue a synchronization license for the master, meaning you can't license the master to another film or television show or a commercial for a number of years, if not forever. The theory is they don't want someone else getting the goodwill of a song closely identified with their picture. The other kicker is that some film companies require the right to use your recording in sequels and remakes of the film, as well as ancillary uses such as theme park shows and attractions, movie-related merchandise, and studio tours. You almost always have to give up these rights, but sometimes you can get an additional fee for the use. Either it's a set fee per use, which the film company pays according to a schedule in the contract, or sometimes, with a lot of clout, you can leave it to be negotiated in good faith at the time of the use, with the provision that you can't stop them from using it, you just get to argue about the size of the fee. Another issue is co-promotions. That's where the film company ties into an advertiser, such as McDonald's, Burger King, Le Sex Shop, etc. These folks do things like give away plastic cups and toys to promote the movie, hang posters in their stores, hype the film in their advertising, write the film's name on their men's room walls, etc. As part of this package, the film company will want to use your master in radio and TV commercials that promote both the advertiser and the film, and that's a source of negotiation. You may well object to having your voice on a commercial for something besides the film, certainly without getting paid, and maybe altogether if it's inconsistent with your image. Also, if you're a superstar, the right to use your voice in a commercial is a serious exploitation of your persona. This is usually resolved by bludgeoning you into submission, since the film companies fight hard for these rights. Co-promotions can mean millions in advertising for the film. If you have a lot of clout, you may be able to get a pre-negotiated additional payment, or even prohibit some or all co-promotions without your consent, which means you can make a deal later, if you're willing to allow it, but otherwise they can't do it. Another compromise is to limit how the song is used in the co-promotion. For example, it can only be used to promote the film itself, not to promote the product. You may also be able to get category restrictions for co-promotions, though they usually give you things that wouldn't likely sponsor the film anyway, like tobacco or firearms. Or if you have an existing sponsor relationship. For example, Pepsi won't be happy if you endorse them and the film company uses your recording in a co-promotion with Coke. Alcohol may be an issue if the film wants to go after that demographic, since liquor folks pay big bucks for co-promotions. But if you have a personal concern about being associated with liquor, they'll usually respect that. You also want to be careful about credit on the soundtrack album cover, and in particular, CD stickers. Obviously a dwindling issue, but still around. Particularly if you're a major artist, your label, and you too, won't want your name used more prominently to sell the product. Most record labels only allow your name to be listed as long as at least three or four other artists on the album are listed, and they'll say that your name can't be larger or more prominent than any others. They may also require the listing to be in alphabetical order to keep you from being the main piece of bait on the hook. Credit. The other major negotiating point is credit. Unless you have the main title song, which I'll talk about in a minute, you won't have much to say about credit. Just make sure your credit is no less prominent than any other artist's, both as to size and placement in the film. In reality, this means you'll be included in the crawl, which are those credits resembling an eye chart that roll by at the end of the film after everyone's left the theater. Everyone except me, that is, because I always stay to see who did the music. Half the time I can't read it, because it goes by too fast. If you do the main title song, meaning the song at the beginning of the picture, as opposed to the end title song, which is, not surprisingly, the song played over the credits at the end, you can sometimes negotiate a credit in the main titles. Main titles are where the director, writer, and stars are credited, and are usually, but not always, at the beginning of the picture. If they're at the end, they're the first credits after the picture finishes. Whether or not you get main title placement, a title song performer should be able to get a single card credit, meaning no other credit is on the screen at the same time as yours, or at least a card shared only with the songwriter. You should also ask for your credit to be the same size as the director's, writer's, and film producer's credit. Record rights to film performances. When we move into soundtrack records, things get more complicated, way more complicated. First, as with your performance in the film, your record company has to sign off. You're their exclusive artist, and if the soundtrack album isn't on their label, they have to agree you can go somewhere else. Assuming you get your record company to go along, then you not only need to negotiate a deal for the use of your recording in the film, which involves the same issues we discussed in the prior section, but also for the use of your recording on the soundtrack album. There are seven, count 'em, seven, aspects to soundtrack album deals. 1. What's your royalty? Is it all in? If you've forgotten what that means, we'll discuss it in a second. Or net to you. 2. Is your royalty paid to you? Rarely. Or to your record company? 3. What can the company distributing the soundtrack album recoup against your royalty? 4. Once the soundtrack distributor recoups and royalties are payable to you, what can your record company recoup against that royalty? 5. Exactly what record rights does the film company get? 6. If your label doesn't distribute the soundtrack album, can your label use the master? And if so, how can they use it? 7. Who's responsible for what in connection with music videos? Let's take these in order. Royalty. Artists' royalties on soundtrack albums generally hover in the range of 12% to 14%, all in, i.e., including the producer, mixer, guest artists, and any other royalty participants. And if you're a new artist, it's sometimes even lower. If you get a net royalty, meaning the record company pays everyone else, and you get to keep everything they pay you, it will of course be lower. At a minimum, they have to pay a producer, but they could be obligated to pay a royalty to a guest artist, mixer, etc. Animated films like to pay even less. Animation pays less for pretty much everything, by the way, since the star is often a singing weasel. If you're mid-level and up, your royalty will almost always be lower than you would get in the marketplace, because the film company takes part of the royalties. Also, this royalty is pro rata, refer back to Chapter 12, which means you only get a small piece of the royalty on albums, because you'll only have one or two cuts out of the 10 or more on the album. In the streaming era, this is becoming less and less relevant, since you get the full amount on single-song streams, and full album sales and downloads are swirling down the drain. But those are still around, so let's go over it. If all the artists on the album are at about the same level, the 12% to 14% pro rata is pretty fair. However, if you're the only star on the record, such as an album whose other cuts are minor artists, or if you're the only song on an album of underscore, meaning the orchestral score, or if you're the only superstar among a bunch of low and mid-level artists, you should definitely get more. In these cases, you're justified in asking for a much higher royalty, say in the 16% to 18% range, sometimes more if you've really got clout. You might also ask for a floor, meaning that no matter how many tracks are on the album, your pro rata royalty will be no less than, say, 1/10th, or 1/11th, or 1/12th, depending on your bargaining power, of the total royalty. For example, if you had a 10% royalty and a floor of 1/10th, you'd get 1% on the album, even if there were 14 masters. Still another technique is to get a non-prorated royalty of, say, 1% to 1.5% on the entire album. The companies will kick and scream, but if you have enough clout, you can pull it off.